Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we speak with a native about a deadly bombing in Turkey. Talks on the Syrian crisis are being held in Geneva. Two messages seen in a German vote. And Pink Floyd's legendary Dark Side of the Moon album is over 40 years old.
The critics raved about it. They said it was some of the best music Pink Floyd had ever made.
It's coming up right here on The Voice of America. Turkey's military said its warplanes carried out 18 airstrikes today, targeting Kurdish militants in northern Iraq. The strikes against the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, came a day after a car bombing killed at least 37 people in Turkey's capital, Ankara. Sunday's blasts happened near Kazali Square, a key shopping and transportation hub near foreign embassies and government buildings. The Turkish health minister said it targeted civilians at a bus stop and that more than 120 people were wounded. Alpa Esmer, a broadcaster in our Turkish service, spoke with VOA Steve Norman.
Alpa, good to have you with us. As a native of Ankara, your thoughts on these attackers going right into the heart of the city?
The location of the bombing Sunday evening is Ankara's main square, where a lot of government offices are present. It is also very crowded commuters up. And the area has been under constant police surveillance with lots of police presence there. And I was there just 2 months ago, and the square is constantly monitored with security cameras. Whether civilians have been intentionally targeted is another question, but the Turkish prime minister is very sure that the car bombing deliberately targeted civilians waiting for their buses there. And the main square in Kızılay, where my high school is nearby, is also where hundreds of thousands of people change their buses, metro trains to commute from one part of the city to the other. It's always a crowded area. Maybe the only blessing, I believe, was because it occurred in Sunday evening with minimal casualties, despite more than 30 people have been killed already. But apparently during a normal weekday, the number of casualties might have been far more.
Yeah. You know, Alpa, a lot of the previous attacks have been the blame has been placed on the Kurdish insurgents, the so-called Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. We talk a lot about that in the news. We're also hearing of recent times the threat by the Islamic State militants as well. The country seems under siege.
It's true. I mean, like Ankara has experienced three bomb attacks in the past 6 months, and one of them was actually the act of ISIS. And, what I can tell you is, Turkey has been battling on multiple fronts these days. Its Kurdish insurgency on one hand, the clashes in its Kurdish towns, the Islamic State terrorism, the civil war in neighboring Syria, the insecure borders, international dispute with Moscow and Damascus, they all make it very hard to speculate who might be behind this attack in Ankara. But the government has not yet pointed any fingers on any group or individuals so far. I mean, the interior minister said the investigators have collected various evidences in relation to who might be behind the attack, but he refrained from laying the accusation on someone. However, he said Turkey's determination to fight against terrorism will not be stopped by such attacks. Also, the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has made a similar statement, saying the Turkish government will not be deterred to use its right to self-defense against terrorism. All these references may point to the PKK or its affiliates, because the Turkish government's current war on terrorism practically is only against the Kurdish insurgents rather than the Islamic State. And I believe the government will not be too hasty to declare the alleged perpetrator of the attack, because it had acted too early to blame the YPG, the Kurdish forces in Syria fighting ISIS, just hours after the bomb attack last month in Ankara, which claimed 30 lives back then. But it later turned out to be another Kurdish group, a splinter organization of the PKK.
Our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is in the studio to tell us what's buzzing online today. Hello, G.
Hi, Susan. The U.S. presidential race continues to dominate the social media platform here in the States, One of the trending stories is Saturday night's GOP convention in Washington, D.C. Florida Senator Marco Rubio won, with Ohio Governor John Kasich coming in a close second. Billionaire Donald Trump placed third. Rubio's communications director, Alex Conant, sent out this tweet. D.C. has changed a lot in the last decade. It's a minority-majority city that's embracing the future, and today voted for it.
And gee, Trump has received endorsement from one of his former rivals.
That's right. Ben Carson announced his endorsement for Trump and sent out a couple of tweets about it. One of them reads like this. Many people fight for change in D.C. Donald Trump is a leader with an outsider's perspective and the vision, guts, and energy to get it done. Now, speaking of Trump, a video of his supporter yelling what many people perceived as racist remarks at protesters is going viral.
Well, tell us more about it.
Sure. So this happened at a Trump campaign rally in Cleveland, Ohio, where a man carrying a Trump sign was videotaped yelling, "Go to Auschwitz," to protesters, also using profanity. But guess who will be going to Auschwitz voluntarily? Pope Francis. This is actually one of the trending stories on Facebook right now. The head of the Roman Catholic Church is headed to the former Jewish concentration camp in Poland in late July. The upcoming camp will be the third visit by a pope to the historic site.
Before you go, let's check out the Democratic Party, too. What's happening there?
A skit by the popular Saturday Night Live, or SNL, got a lot of views. One of the members acted as Hillary Clinton, morphing into Bernie Sanders to poke fun at Clinton allegedly adopting many of Sanders' rhetoric to gain support for millennials. Billionaire investor George Soros is also in the headlines for contributing $15 million into a new super PAC to mobilize Latino and immigrant voters. He's an immigrant himself from Hungary. That's all for me today. Susan?
Thanks for the Twitter wrap-up, G. She's on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers say that they have discovered around 80 galaxies that may have existed in the young universe about 12.6 billion years ago. The team developed a list of galaxies to look for from data gathered by the Subaru telescope in Hawaii. With that information, they were able to locate these 80 early galaxies and learn more about them by analyzing imaging data gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope. About 13.6 billion years ago, that's 200 million years after the Big Bang, it's thought that cold gas clouds provided material for the first stars to be born. As these stars were being created, they formed small galaxies. The researchers were able to determine that around 1.2 billion years after the Big Bang, these small galaxies were continuously merging together and growing into larger galaxies like our own Milky Way, which contains about 200 billion stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The latest round of proximity talks on Syria's political future are being held today in Geneva, more than 2 weeks after a cessation of hostilities brought most of the fighting to a halt. However, the government and opposition remain at odds over a key issue, the future of President Bashar al-Assad. The main opposition High Negotiations Committee has indicated the talks should focus on creating a transitional governing body, and Mr. Assad must leave. But Foreign Minister Walid Al-Mulem said his delegation will not talk to anyone who wants to discuss the presidency. That brought a response Sunday from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Paris with several of his Western counterparts.
We all strongly support the U.N. efforts, and we look forward to the resumption of talks in Geneva on Monday. And there isn't a person standing here who doesn't understand how difficult that is. Witness the comments made just yesterday by the foreign minister of Syria, clearly trying to disrupt the process, clearly trying to send a message of deterrence to others. But the fact is that his strongest sponsors, Iran and Russia, have both adopted at the United Nations, in support of it at the United Nations, and in the Vienna communiques and the Munich meetings, an approach which dictates that there must be a political transition and that we must move towards a presidential election at some point in time.
Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in San Antonio, Texas, tells VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype Damascus, backed by Russia's air campaign, has no incentive now to compromise with a weakened opposition.
On the battlefield, they've made gains. Most of the international community, at least those that have been backing the opposition, have shown some flexibility regarding his position in any sort of transition process, or flexibility regarding whether or not he can remain in power. So from his point of view, stay the course. I think before any negotiations anyhow, both sides are going to take maximalist positions and then leave open the possibility to negotiate. I think that's probably the opposition point of view. I think from the point of view of the Syrian regime, I mean, there's no way the negotiators are going to go there and negotiate the ouster of their boss. I mean, it's a non-starter from their point of view, as Syrian Foreign Minister Walid Mualim said. And I happen to know that, you know, in any sort of Syrian government negotiating team, you have those who are out front, but there are those with more power who are in the background. And they're the ones that, you know, really are pulling the strings on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. And they will keep Bashar al-Assad informed, and they'll make sure the negotiators who are in the public eye stay the course. So this is not surprising to me at all. I personally do not think the Syrian regime has any intention of stepping aside. And they have repeated the mantra, as has the Russians, that it's up to the Syrian people to decide and not the subject of negotiations.
Are these doomed to fail?
If that becomes the sticking issue, if the Syrian opposition holds to that position that they won't go any further without any guarantees that Assad will step down, it will go no further, and they will break down. And especially at this point in the game, in terms of Syrian government now being assertively backed by Russian military involvement and having made gains in the battlefield, there's no reason for them to make these sort of concessions from their point of view at this time.
Could this threaten the cessation of hostilities, in your view?
Absolutely, it could threaten it. I think what Secretary of State Kerry is doing is trying to pressure his Russian counterparts to compel the Syrian government negotiating team to be a little bit more flexible. But I just don't see that happening right now.
But David Lesh also believes the U.S. does not see Russian involvement in the conflict as open-ended, and, given the upcoming U.S. election, believes it has some leverage with Moscow to get a political agreement done on Syria before November. Coming up on International Edition, a revealing German vote, and we visit the dark side of the moon. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's ruling Christian Democratic Union suffered an electoral defeat in Sunday's regional elections, primarily over her migration policy that has allowed more than 1 million asylum seekers, mostly from the Middle East and South Asia, in over the past year. Voters opted for the relatively new Alternative for German party. Hannah Cleaver, a freelance reporter from Deutsche Welle, says the outcome is somewhat complicated because voters were sending two messages.
The first most surprising thing for an international audience, perhaps, is that a large number of them have told Angela Merkel, we do not like your policy of allowing migrants and largely refugees coming into Germany without any restrictions, and it seems there are a lot of people in Germany who are very unhappy with that. You've had more than 1 million people come into Germany over the last year, and one of the clear messages to Merkel was, this is upsetting an awful lot of people in Germany. The second message to Merkel is really a more complicated internal domestic German question, but is also useful to look at from an international perspective. It is that people are still actually largely in favor of this policy. This is German people speaking with two tongues, if you like. One of the newspapers today had the very sarcastic headline, 85% of voters remain cool, which is actually also the case. Her party herself, itself, the CDU, was punished at the polls. But her policy of allowing Syrian refugees into the country, of welcoming them, of pulling out all the stops possible to actually increase and encourage integration of refugees into Germany, that was largely supported, even though it was supported then by other parties than her own. So it is a complicated picture, but you do have this shocking for outsiders results, particularly in this eastern state of Saxony and Anhalt, where you had just over 24% of people voting for this Alternative for Deutschland party, which was set up initially to oppose European Union and has now turned into a very critical, one might even say, anti-refugee party.
Will this change the Merkel policy on migration at all?
No, she can't and she won't. I think this is one of the really central parts of her philosophy, if you like, if one can say she even has one. She's a very pragmatic politician, but this is something that she has invested an awful lot of her political capital into. She's been in power now for 10 years. I think this is going to be her legacy. Whether she manages to turn it into a positive one or only a middling one, this is something she's absolutely going to stick by. And she does have the support of her coalition partners, the Social Democrats, and of the Greens, who had a very strong showing in these elections. So she's not going to change track. What you do have, though, is this emergence of a right-wing party, which Germany has so far not had, really, since the war.
As for Ms. Merkel's own political future, Cleaver says as of now, she has no rival who comes anywhere near her stature, and she seems safe for re-election to a fourth term. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The passage of time is a common musical theme. It relates to all of us. Pink Floyd's legendary Dark Side of the Moon album devoted much of its outpouring to the subject, including a track titled Time. Now 43 years of time has passed since it was released. Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald spoke with VOA's Jim Stevenson about Dark Side of the Moon, which remains a huge fan favorite.
It's an ageless album, Jim. On March 10th, 1973, Harvest Records released Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd in the United States. And this was an album that the band had been working on for quite some time. They had developed the songs during live performances, and they performed an early version of the album in February 1972 at the Rainbow Theatre in London, a full year before the album was released.
And weren't those fans lucky, and they didn't know.
Exactly. The critics raved about it. They said it was some of the best music Pink Floyd had ever made. The album itself was recorded from June 1972 to January 1973 at the famous Abbey Road Studios in London. And it was a unified piece of music. The songs flowed into each other using special sound effects and spoken word excerpts. It took a lot of the concepts and ideas that Pink Floyd had used in their earlier albums. This was their eighth album. But it was a much more unified piece of work than anything they'd done before. It looked at themes of greed, the passage of time, themes of mental illness, which was partly inspired by the mental breakdown of one of their founding members, Syd Barrett, in the late 60s. And people absolutely responded to it. Roger Waters, their bassist, said that he played the album for his wife, and she burst into tears at the end of it. So he says, right at that moment, I knew that we were going to find an audience. It certainly did. Dark Side of the Moon remained on the U.S. album charts for 741 total weeks from 1973 to 1988. And no other album has ever done this.
That's astounding.
It only was number one for 1 week, but it hung around the charts for 741 total weeks. The album sold an estimated 45 million copies worldwide. It's one of the best-selling albums of all time. And moreover, Dark Side of the Moon elevated Pink Floyd from a respected mid-level rock band to a global superstar act, where they remained right up until the end of their career.
Technology also helped this album because we were so familiar with it, and by the time the 90s rolled around and CDs came out, we had almost a fresh listen to it.
Yeah, it was always a favorite among headphone listeners because of the depth of the production and the complexity of it all. FM radio stations of the 1970s would often play the entire record side as one track flowed into the next. In addition, it had a couple hit singles, Time, Money. Everybody knew the music, and it seemed like every subset of music fans found something to like about it. Its appeal went right across the board, and it is 43 years old this week.
Speaking of numbers, we like our favorite number. That's the top 20 countdown. Ray McDonald is your host. Ray's also on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Follow him. Listen to him. Thanks for joining us, Ray.
Thank you, Jim.
The time is gone. The song is over. Thought I'd something more to say.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The periodic warming of sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean, known as El Niño, causes weather and short-term climate changes in other parts of the globe. The El Niño of 2015-2016 is the strongest on record, and nowhere have been extreme weather effects associated with El Niño been more intensely felt than in Ethiopia. Last summer's Kirimt, or main rainy season, has been weak, and the short spring bell grains are delayed. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the resulting drought, the worst Ethiopia has experienced in 5 decades, has led to successive crop failures and widespread livestock deaths, tripling the humanitarian needs. Some 10.2 million Ethiopians are now chronically hungry, while some 7.5 million farmers and herders need immediate agricultural support to produce both grains and livestock in the coming season. Since October 2014, the United States has provided over $500 million in aid to Ethiopia and another $4 million worth of seeds, a critical need for farmers, given that the planting season will begin soon. But this year, we are taking an extra step, one we feel is necessary if we are to prevent this crisis from growing much, much worse. Instead of waiting for the situation to develop into a full-blown emergency, we are sending in a disaster assistance response team, a group of experts that will evaluate the situation on the ground, pinpoint gaps in the aid plan, and accelerate and expand the emergency response, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We are moving earlier in this case because we have found that there is real agreement between donors, NGOs, the government, and UN agencies that if we move very, very quickly, we can avert the worst impacts of this drought. We hope that by taking this step, we will lead the rest of the international community, said Administrator Smith. If we move now, if other donors move with us, we think we can do 2 things. Avert the worst impacts and protect some of the development gains that the country has made over many years, she said. We are challenging the world not just to respond to human suffering, but to respond quickly enough to prevent something even worse.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.